Welcome to the Triple D Podcast, Donuts, Disability, and Discourse, where host Michael Leiner talks to the best in the business about community, impact, business, and donuts. Here's your host, Michael Leiner.
Welcome to another edition of the Triple D Podcast. I am so excited to have our distinguished guest today. I love what we've been doing the last little bit is we've been bringing in experts from all around the country, and today certainly qualifies. We have Patsy Katsos, who is an internationally recognized expert on the implementation of what's called low FODMAP diets. You're going to correct me on that.
Yeah.
But specifically, you work with patients who have GI conditions, which so many of our clients have. Tell us a little bit about your background, Patsy.
Okay. Well, I'm a registered dietitian nutritionist. And as you say, I work one-on-one with patients who have a variety of GI conditions. I have a telehealth practice that's more or less national. And I frequently get referrals from gastroenterologists or primary care doctors to work with their patients. Sometimes my patients self-refer. And, you know, we work together to meet their nutrition goals and to try to treat their condition from the diet and nutrition side while they also work with their physician on other kinds of treatments.
Is there like a level of severity that somebody would, you know, do people make it to you when they have like a particularly severe health condition affecting their GI tract? Or is it, you know, I was just diagnosed and I want to manage my diet? Where do people come to you?
You know, that's kind of an interesting question because it's changed tremendously over the last 15 years. You know, at that time, I was really working in a more general nutrition role, helping people with their blood pressure and cholesterol and so on. And I had people coming to me saying, you know, oh, and by the way, you know, I have diarrhea 15 times a day. And, you know, 15, 20 years ago, we just did not have that much to offer them. So then the FODMAP approach came along, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little more, and a lot of other great new ideas for how to help people with GI conditions. And so I started offering that kind of help in my practice. So people were kind of new to the idea that there really are some specialty diets and other strategies to help. A lot of doctors back then would tell patients, you know, you can eat whatever you want. It doesn't matter. Now, zooming
that
up
sounds
to today,
comical to me.
Yeah. today, I think, you know, the word is out. So a lot of the people who come to me have tried a lot of the ideas that are available now on the internet or in books to help themselves. And I tend to get more clients these days who are just not getting the results they need from all the self-help that's available.
Introduce the FODMAP diet to us. What is that? It's an acronym, right? So what does that mean?
Yes, it is an acronym for a bunch of jargon.
Okay.
It's if you're an information seeker, you might like to know it stands for fermentable oligo, di, and monosaccharides and polyols.
I'm pretty sure you lost all of our listeners at fermental.
Yeah. I usually just tell my patients it's referring to a group of certain sugars and certain fibers in food that can cause GI distress.
Okay. And what are like the baseline traits of the diet? What are you really preaching to people?
So I could answer that question on a few levels. Would it be okay if I talked a little more about where FODMAPs are and food and so on before?
Please.
Okay.
Please, yeah, educate us.
All right. So the idea is with these FODMAPs that they can cause digestive distress because they have a couple things in common. First of all, they are the favorite foods of the normal gut bacteria. So if we eat more of them in one sitting than we can handle, the gut bacteria might rapidly ferment them, and that can blow your intestines up a little bit like a balloon, and that causes a lot of discomfort. The other thing that FODMAPs have in common is they can pull a lot of extra fluid into the intestines. That's called osmosis. And that, now you have a water balloon effect going on in there. That can also cause your intestines to distend a little bit and cause discomfort and, if not actual pain. And it's not hard to picture how that could contribute to a bout of diarrhea, right?
Right.
So the way we get started on this is to undertake a learning process called an elimination diet. And, you know, that is definitely more than a list of high and low FODMAP foods. It's a whole strategy and a plan to try to figure out what your FODMAP food triggers are, if you have them.
And so if somebody were to start with like that elimination diet, it's interesting. I love hearing you talk about this because you're not just educating our listeners. These are things that I see in medical records for my clients all the time when they're working with doctors, they're working with the nutritional team. How do you go about that? Is it about taking away things slowly, or is it by like just having them eat very baseline foods and adding things in and seeing what might trigger a symptom? How does that work?
Great question. There are many ways to approach the project. And there are other kinds of elimination diets, but I'm going to talk about a FODMAP elimination diet because that's the one that I find helps the most people manage their IBS symptoms. It helps about 85% of IBS patients get better symptom management. So what the FODMAP elimination diet consists of is a three-stage process. The first stage, you try to eat only low FODMAP foods. You could say you try to eliminate FODMAPs. That's where the elimination diet phrase comes from. But really, you're not eliminating them completely. You're just cutting way back during the first phase and eating a low FODMAP diet. Then, you know, if you don't get any improvement in your symptoms, you kind of walk away from it because there's no benefit, right? No benefit.
Right.
So, but if you do feel a lot better, then you go on to the second stage of the process, which is to reintroduce foods. And rather than doing that willy-nilly, you know, just kind of random, whatever comes along, you actually do it in a really controlled way that isolates the variables and can really help people specifically identify which FODMAPs are their particular triggers, because it is individual. And then the third phase, you kind of put all that together and go forward with your life, trying to eat the most varied diet you can tolerate.
Okay. Let me ask this. So we're in the grocery store now. Let's give people some objective takeaways. What are the foods that you find are, you know, first of all, what are the foods that we'd call FODMAP foods?
Yep. So FODMAPs are widely distributed in our diet. That's why we're not going to have a true elimination of them. They are widely distributed in our diet. And the same exact foods can be high, medium, or low in FODMAPs, depending on the serving size. So, you know, 10, 15 years ago, when this idea was new, we used to talk about foods in more black and white terms, like this one's high FODMAP, this one's low FODMAP. But now we realize, you know, there's a lot of gray area in between. So I will name a few foods that are probably, you know, big sources of FODMAPs in the diets of Americans. But I don't want people to think that they're bad foods or that they can never have these foods again if they have IBS. But, you know, typical high FODMAP foods include like liquid milk products, you know, a glass of milk. Because lactose is one of the FODMAPs. So, you know, but it's nuanced. A glass of milk might be a problem, but cheese tends to be very low in lactose. So it's not a dairy-free diet. But, you know, milk products, apples, watermelon, you know, those are some real high FODMAP foods. Apples in particular, people have the idea that, you know, should be. And they're not wrong. They should be a nice, healthy food that you should eat frequently. But that can be, the sugars in the apple can be too much of a good thing for some people. Mm-hmm. So if you're eating a couple apples a day, that can be a problem. Wheat products. are big sources of FODMAPs for Americans because we tend to eat them morning, noon, and night, right? Everything from breakfast cereal to sandwiches and pizza and pasta. But again, in case your listeners know a little bit about wheat products, they might think, oh, gluten, maybe. But this does not have to be a gluten-free diet either. So that's another real nuanced part. And then onions and garlic, sadly, are very high in FODMAPs. And a lot of us eat a lot of those foods, especially if we like spicy foods. You know, some people wonder if they should limit spicy foods, but it tends to be the onions and the garlic in those foods that causes more trouble than the actual spices themselves.
That's interesting because I've always heard people talk about avoiding spicy foods when they have a GI issue,
but it's
more the spices behind it than it is the spice itself. So, you know, things like peppers, maybe some curries, if they're not heavy in garlic or onions, they might be okay for people.
They might work. Yeah. Okay. So some of the most fun parts of this process are helping people realize that through the process that they actually can enjoy a lot more of these foods than they thought they could. You know, they can have some cheese again. If they've been avoiding dairy, they can have some small servings of wheat products or enjoy sourdough bread if they've been avoiding gluten and so on.
Are there commonalities that you see where, regardless of where on the spectrum of severity somebody is, or you find that there are certain foods that just are not good for people who have GI problems when you're working with them?
Well, they're probably those same foods I just mentioned.
Okay.
You know, the onions, the garlic, and like frequent large servings of wheat products. I think those are way up there.
Okay. Now, stepping outside of the diet for a second, I'm interested because you have a telehealth practice, you're working with people from all over the country. How does that work for a registered dietitian? Do you have to be licensed in a particular state? What's the process for that?
Good question. So registered dietitians have a national credential. We are credentialed by the Commission for Dietetic Registration, which is sort of an arm of our professional association. So while in most states, anyone can call themselves a nutritionist, a dietitian has to actually have, you know, the prescribed education and 1,000 hours of supervised practice, pass a national exam, and keep up on continuing professional education. So that's the RD or the RDN part of my credentials, and we're allowed to use either one of those phrases. If you want to be a dietitian who provides medical nutrition therapy or clinical care, you do have to be licensed in some states, but not in others. So, for example, I am licensed in Maine and New Hampshire, not in other states. But if the licensure law in other states doesn't prohibit the practice of medical nutrition therapy by others, then, you know, there's no legal barrier to doing so. But if the state has a strong licensure law, then I would not be able to work with a patient who is receiving services in that state.
That's interesting. I want to throw out a common objection to you that I hear from my clients when it comes to like special diets or, anything that involves like a change to their food habits. Mm-hmm. So many of my clients, they're out of work. They don't have an income, and their response to, changing their diet is I'm living on food stamps. I can't afford to go shop at Whole Foods.
Yeah.
Tell me what your response to that would be, because that's a myth, isn't it? That it's not about the affordability of it, that it's so expensive to have foods that will work with your health problem.
Right. That is it is something that people experience. It's the It's not uncommon for people to be concerned about the cost of eating healthier.
Sure.
And, you know, undertaking a special diet. That's perfectly understandable. But I do think it is a myth to a large extent. You know, some people have more money than time, and some people have more time than money. And, you know, I think that if a person has the extra time to prepare more foods at home and do more scratch cooking, it doesn't necessarily have to be expensive at all. Low FODMAP diet actually works best when the food is very simply prepared. So
what do you mean by that?
Well, you whole foods, you know, foods that don't come in a package, box or can, and don't have lists of ingredients that you have to cope with. You know, they are very easy to understand as to whether they're high, medium, or low in fat FODMAPs by using some of the resources that are available today. So if you just stick to simple foods like, whole fruits and vegetables from the produce department, and if you can put a little extra time into prepping them yourself, I think that goes a long way toward making this diet more affordable.
Great.
If you're used to eating a lot of prepared foods, that is going to be a little bit of a change. If you want to replace, your current frozen meals with a special diet frozen meals, that's where it gets expensive. I'd like to give you a few more examples of that.
Please.
For the low FODMAP diet, some of the most suitable foods are very affordable. For example, while you might not be able to eat as many wheat products as usual, just simply prepared rice and potatoes work really well on this diet. You don't have to buy fancy replacement products, you know, expensive gluten-free baked goods or gluten-free pastas. Just, you know, while you're trying this learning diet, eat more rice and potatoes. That couldn't be easier or cheaper, really. And, you know, there are similar strategies for all the other food groups.
Okay. You've given us so much great information, Patsy, and I really appreciate your time and the conversation. Are there any like final thoughts, anything that you think that people who maybe have a more severe condition to the degree where they're struggling to work and provide for themselves? Is there anything else, any other thoughts that you think would be important to leave them with?
Well, you know, if you believe that you have irritable bowel syndrome, you should definitely have it properly evaluated by a healthcare provider, either your own primary care doc or gastroenterologist, to make sure that that really is what's gone wrong here. And, you know, if possible, ask your doctor for a referral to a registered dietitian to help you navigate the diet process. Low FODMAP diet is not right for everyone, and your doctor or dietitian can talk with you about whether you're a good candidate for a special diet like this or not. You know, if you do need to try this diet, it's a lot easier to do with the help of a dietitian. If that is not available to you, there are a lot of good self-help resources out there. You know, the number one resource that I recommend is the Monash University Low FODMAP app, which is extremely helpful, and many people can use it independently to see whether the FODMAP approach can help them or not.
You've given us, like I said, so much great information. If people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
I have a website, ibsfree.net, where I publish a few articles about FODMAPs and irritable bowel syndrome. And I have a blog and a newsletter that people can connect with and learn more about this idea. And they can even submit questions to me through my website. And whenever possible, I answer those in future editions of my newsletter.
Can I find the newsletter on your website?
There's a form that you can use to sign up for the newsletter on the website. Great. Yes.
Great. Well, thank you again so much, Patsy. I really appreciated the conversation. And I know that everybody who's watching this and listening to this out there is benefiting from this as well. So I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Triple D Podcast, Donuts, Disability, and Discourse. Rate, subscribe, and tune in next week for more discourse and donuts.